Hello and welcome back to Millennial 8, and I'm now here with Dan from the Fergan. Am I pronouncing that correctly?
You are, yeah. And yeah, good to be here, Woz. Thank you for having me.
Okay, you're very welcome. I think this is your third time on Millennial.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, the first one was the crypto for the crypto Nats one. And then, yes. Yeah, last year you had me on as the Fergan. So yeah, it's the third one.
Okay, excellent. And of course, in the interim, we have met IRL. Yeah. At the Pagan Futures thing, but we'll get to that later. Yes, it's nice to have you back. And so why don't you, just for the sake of anyone who doesn't know you, introduce yourself briefly.
Sure. Yeah, first thing I just need to say that the jingle for your intro has been stuck in my head all day, honestly. Good work with that.
Sorry about that. Oh, thank you very much. Yeah, it was all done in a bit of a rush, but the music, but I think it's quite nice.
Yeah. Yeah, my name's Dan. I'm an English heathen musician, podcaster, kind of somewhat reluctant commentator on socio-political affairs. Family man, living in rural Wales. That about covers it in a nutshell.
All right. Yeah, there's a lot of different things there that you're involved with. I think the main thing that I know you for, and perhaps most people know you for, is as a social commentator. Even though, as you say, it's not something that you are sort of wholeheartedly joyous about. Why don't you talk briefly about that, the sort of relationship between, you know, being an e-celeb, being a public figure, being a commentator, all of that kind of thing.
It's weird to be called that. I mean, the Fergan, I mean, because really I'm only active on Telegram and Odyssey. I kind of stopped releasing stuff on YouTube because I got a strike for one of my first videos for mentioning the vaccine, the so-called vaccine. So I just thought, well, fuck it, why bother? I mean, because I consider myself a musician, a creator. I like to be artistic. I like to create things. I like to try and bring joy and a certain amount of escapism to the world. But when 2020 hit, I knew that kind of comfortable distance that I'd kept from commentating on these things, I knew that I could no longer with any good conscience maintain that distance. So I started speaking up, and I created, because I was kind of known as a musician for being in a couple of bands, one of them being my dark folk project Walkinsman, and I wanted to create something separate to that, because I'm really against musicians forcing their views on their listeners. You know, I'm sure everyone's had that. You know, your favorite band will start speaking up about something or against something. Usually they come out in favor of something like BLM, or they start telling everyone to get vaccinated or something like that. And your heart sinks because you're a huge fan of their music. And whilst I'm on the opposite side of that, you know, in a general sense, I am aware that lots of people who listen to my music didn't necessarily want to know my views on what's going on in the world, and may not even be interested in my spiritual take on things as well. So I was quite conscious to create a separate kind of persona.
I think that was definitely the right decision for the reasons that you've said. It's annoying when, I mean, and you know, for most of us, the musicians that we're like, a lot of them will be politically opposed to us, like very, very politically opposed to us. So it is dismaying when they start preaching about, you know, how wonderful the refugees are and LGBT rights and all this stuff, when, you know, it's way beyond what it needs to be. And so I can understand. I think you're right to separate the two to a great extent.
Yeah, and I think most people who knew me for my music and were interested in my more philosophical takes, they've found the Fergan, even though I've not really advertised it through my musical avenues. I've just been very conscious to keep them separate. But anyway, that's how the Fergan you know, persona brand channels came about I think it was early 2021. And the reason for that was because prior to that, I was still in a band who, out of respect for them, I didn't want to come out vocally about these kinds of issues whilst I was still a member of that band. So one of the reasons that I left the band was because I wanted to be free to speak about these things. So early 2021, I think it was, the Fergan channel was born. Something's just fallen down. it's just grown from there, and now it's quite a few followers and that, and it's great. It's been really great kind of sharing these this journey and the ideas and thoughts that so many of us have with so many like-minded people.
Indeed. And of course, there is a lot of debate within the sphere, and you and I have been very much on the side of, we're getting to the history here, but you and I have been very much on the side of that COVID was a big deal. The World Economic Forum is a, or whatever it represents, is a, because that might be the front face of it, is a big deal. And Agenda 2030 and so on are relevant things. So you said that it was in 2020 that you felt things had changed. And I'm sure that people are familiar with this. We've gone into it before. But what would you say happened? How would you characterize the change in life on Earth, or at least in the West, in 2020? In retrospect, what would you say happened there?
The way I look at it is it was a gloves off moment. So I've been aware of what the long term agenda for the globalists, you know, whatever you want to call them, the New World Order, let's leave it at that. I've been aware of what they've been working towards for a long time. I mean, since before I even got involved with nationalism, I was, you know, a so-called conspiracy theorist, you know, many years ago. And I kind of came to nationalism from that side of things, actually through 9/11, seeing how the BBC had misreported 9/11 with my own eyes, and coming to mistrust the mainstream media completely, and then wondering what else they were lying to me about and things like that. So I've kind of been, you know, you have this idea, you listen, you know, you absorb some of the ideas of people like David Icke and stuff like that, and yeah, some of it's rubbish, some of it's good, whatever, but you do have this general sense that they are working towards increased totalitarian control over humanity. And you're not sure exactly what form that's going to take. You don't know exactly what steps they're going to take next. You know, you come to realize that things like central banking, financial slavery, usury are part of it. You come to realize that mass weaponized immigration is part of it. You come to realize that, poor quality foods, pharmaceuticals, things like that are part of it. But when COVID hit in 2020, I went, ah, that's it. This is it. This is their kind of big push forwards. And I knew it immediately for what it was. I knew exactly what I had a good idea about what they were going to use that to introduce the whole cashless society. So mandatory vaccinations, social credit system, digital ID. Yeah. Because, you know, back in, I think it was 2008, Tony Blair, the Labour, they were pushing this campaign to introduce a national ID, which I kind of lightly campaigned against. You know, I was flyering and stickering and things at the time for that. So I knew back then that they desperately wanted everyone to have some form of ID. And with how digital society is becoming, I knew that they were going to try and merge those things. So, I saw when COVID hit, I was actually on tour around Europe when in end of February, beginning of March, and my flight home got cancelled because the airline went bust because of COVID. This was at the very, very, very early stages where people were stopping traveling because they were scared of this so-called pandemic and things. It's just I saw it as a gloves off moment. I thought, well, you know, here then there's going to be no pretense anymore, really, that we live in any kind of a free society. This is them showing that, you know, the power that they really truly have. And I think everything we've seen since then has just been an expansion of that.
Absolutely. And an interesting example of this is, you mentioned the ID cards thing. You said 2008. It was actually earlier than that. It was apparently, there's an article here, apparently the Identity Cards Act 2006. Right. And I'm pretty sure it was like 2004 when they first mentioned that kind of time. Definitely, I remember it being there in 2005. And so, yeah, 2006 was when it was, there was actually an Act of Parliament, which I'd forgotten about. But what's interesting, and it ties in to what you were just saying, what's interesting is how much things felt different then. In 2005, 6, 7, there was a sense that you could protest something, as you did, and that would have some kind of effect. In other words, that our nations were to some extent under our control, or we could influence what happened in them. And I think that is what's different now, post-COVID, because you now feel like they're just going to go ahead and do whatever they like. I mean, it's just not like 2005, 6, where public objections to something will deter the politicians from implementing that thing. It doesn't feel like that anymore. It feels now that the politicians no longer behave as if they're serving us, the public. They're now quite open. They're actually serving other people. I don't know. What would you say about that?
Well, I kind of disagree a little bit, in the sense that for many years I've believed that they don't serve our interests. I saw how, you know, I was around at the time to see how that, you know, I was somewhat sympathetic to the likes of the BNP, and I saw how they were treated by the media when they started gaining some ground. Many years ago, I was involved with a charity for the English called the Steadfast Trust, which was never given charity status because their aim was to aid English children to put storytellers into English schools to teach English heritage to children. So they were never even granted charity status. I'd also, you know, for years ago, I'd seen documentaries like The Money Masters, and I knew that really politicians don't control anything. It's who controls the politician that controls everything, and that's the money masters, you know, the central bankers. So in that sense, 2020 and COVID was kind of I try not to kind of come across as a smug or I told you so or anything like that, because I don't think that's helpful, but it was kind of I felt exonerated at that time, because for many years, even people in the kind of nationalist dissident scene had said to me, oh, you're too conspiratorial. You know, politics will work. Democracy will work. We just need to do this. We just need to do that. And I think a lot of people realized in 2020 that that's not the case. And for me, that was actually a really huge white pill, because for me, it was like, right, finally, a lot more people see what I see, and we can move ahead in a more workable direction.
Yeah, I mean, I think I always struggle to remember what my mindset was at any particular point in time. But I certainly remember in 2018, early 2018, a sequence of things happened in Britain that made me think, it's as if there's a darkness approaching. Things are getting serious. The government is getting quite heavy-handed in a way that they hadn't been before then, at least not that I'd seen. There was just a sense of a sort of encroaching authoritarianism.
And I think that part of that surely is because so many people had pinned a lot of hope on Trump in 2016, 2017. And I think by 2018, I think everyone who had placed some stock in Trump realized that this is probably isn't actually going anywhere.
Oh yeah, but I mean, within Britain, so right. Like Brittany Pettibone and Martin Selner got banned. Tommy Robinson got put in prison. Dankula got convicted. I think there was a fourth thing. I can't remember now. Oh, Lauren Southern even got banned from Britain. So all of this stuff happened within the space of like, I think, 2 months, something like that, March, April. And that was scary. You know, that felt like a watershed moment. And you know, whenever something happens, it's a sign not of how things now are, but how they've been for some time. And this is just it manifesting, becoming visible now. So I know it didn't come from nowhere. I know it wasn't out of the blue. But nonetheless, that was a scary moment for me. But then, as I say, 2 years later, 2020, COVID, that really was an eye-opener for me. And I'll freely admit it. You know, I was naive about the way that power works and the systems that were in place already, the incredible degree of harmonization and efficiency of communication, all of that was I hadn't realized until it all started, until the yeah. cogs started turning there.
And I remember you wrote a really great candid Telegram post kind of expressing your surprise at what had happened, and you know, you very honestly went through how it had kind of blindsided you and things. And I thought that was a really great post, because I think that expresses the feelings that so many people had during that time.
Yeah, I think I remember the one that you're referring to. But thank you for saying that. I mean, it just seems like when you're wrong or when you've been wrong, the first thing to do is just to face it, admit it. Because otherwise you're going to be expending a lot of energy and time and wasting other people's time trying to deny that you were wrong. So it's a waste of time and energy. And, you know, it's not like I was entirely wrong about everything.
No, not at all.
But I certainly was wrong about this aspect of the way the world works. So, you know, that was, it was not something embarrassing for me to admit to. But there are people, I'm certainly not going to name any names, but there are people who even now deny the significance of all of this. And I guess what they would say about COVID is that COVID is over, and it really didn't signify anything very novel, and it hasn't had any long-lasting effects. And in fact, I've even seen people say that life today is pretty much as it was in 2019. And that to me is just intuitively untrue. It's just intuitively wrong. Life, you know, life does not feel the same as it did in 2019. I don't know what it is. It's difficult to sort of say tangible things.
There are tangible and intangible things. Yeah, I mean, I, for example, I have very elderly grandparents in the Netherlands who I've not been able to see for 3 years. It's been at least 3 years since I've seen them, because the Netherlands have only just lifted the ban, a couple of months ago on unvaccinated Brits traveling there. You know, and I know people will probably say, oh, I've been to the Netherlands and I wasn't checked and things, but you know, I've got three children and a wife. I can't book a trip for an entire family and hope that the border guard is going to be, you know, another one of those ones who just kind of waves us across. You know, I need to know for certain that they're not going to prevent us from traveling to the Netherlands because we don't have the vaccinations, or the prick, as I like to call it. We still can't go to America, Brits. You still need. I spoke to a friend the other day who just got back from Texas. He had to show papers the entire way there to get into Texas to show that he'd been vaccinated. Otherwise, they weren't going to let him in. So it's still very tangibly a real thing. And yeah, as you say, and I think you've got this point across quite well in the millennial episodes that I've listened to, that there is this kind of just this atmosphere. It's almost hard to explain, but things have changed and people have become more malleable. And
more fearful.
Fearful. Yeah. And I think, you know, it's this gloves off mentality. It's this kind of, everyone knows now that their freedom has a price, you know, and most people have signified that to their overlords. They have signified that their freedom does have a price and that they will pay that price if need be. And that's a huge watershed moment. And I don't think that can be downplayed.
No, I mean, I guess you could try to just ignore it. You could try to just pretend that things are fine and things are as they were, and then try to engage with the world as if it's 2019 again. But I don't think it would work out well. You know, things like doing conferences, the threat in 2019 was Antifa. Antifa will storm the conference. They'll photograph people outside. They'll petition the authorities and so on. And they did do all of that stuff. But now it's not even on the agenda to have a conference because we now know what we're up against. Now, I don't want to be black. I certainly don't want to blackpill people. I'm just saying we do need to reappraise what we've been doing and how to proceed. I mean, I guess that would bring us quite elegantly to, is there anything else that you'd want to say about COVID, the World Economic Forum and Agenda 2030? Because it is a huge thing.
Yeah. I think there's a lot to be said about that. What people need to realize is that even if you want to say COVID is over, fine. I'm not even bothered about anyone who wants to say that, even though I would, you know, disagree to an extent. But COVID was always part of a bigger agenda. And so many of us have been trying to get that point across since 2020. I did a Morecast with Morgoth in July 2021, where we talked about Agenda 21 and the technocracy. So, you know, it was always part of a bigger thing. And what we're seeing now with the rising fuel prices, which I believe is completely orchestrated, that's a huge part of it. They need people to reduce their reliance on, you know, so-called dirty energy. They want people, they're breaking people's expectations. The Great Reset may be kind of something that certain people snigger at, but it's real. They want to re-engineer society, and that starts with re-engineering people's psychology, our expectations, training us to live differently, to live without heat, to drive less, to not expect interest on our savings, to expect to pay higher interest rates on our mortgages, things like that. All of it plays into Agenda 21, which has been updated in 2015 to Agenda 2030, which is basically the sustainable goals agenda. And what that is in a nutshell is about inventorying the whole of humanity. They want to know who, where, what we're consuming, how we're living, all of these details. They need to, and their justification for this is that this is the only way that they can prevent the end of the world. The only way they can prevent climate change is by knowing how many of us are using too much of this and how many of us are traveling too far and all of these kinds of things. So COVID was always kind of like the first big shunt into Agenda 2030, into this new world of sustainable development goals.
So I guess the question here is the what we're seeing now, the energy shortages, the price rises, and so on, it stems from the Russia sanctions, which stem from the Ukraine war, which stem from Russia invading Ukraine. So a lot of people would say it's got nothing to do. It's not orchestrated. It's got nothing to do with the World Economic Forum and the UN and all that. It's an accidental result of sanctioning Russia so as to deter them and punish them economically for invading Ukraine. What would you say about that?
It's a bit serendipitous, isn't it? It's a bit convenient. I know there are people hitting the downvote now and leaving, enraged comments probably, because no one likes it when you come at the angle that the Russia-Ukraine war may not be quite as organic as they want to think it is, especially people who see Russia and Putin as the kind of last hope against the new world order. I can't say that it is completely orchestrated. I'm not going to say that because I can't prove that. But to me, I just look at things like, well, there are certain issues which before COVID, the issue was the kind of litmus test was, does the nation have a central bank, a privately controlled central bank? You know, a lot of people in our kind of wider circles, you know, were aware of this idea that there were certain nations which didn't have a privately controlled central bank. You know, I think, you know, there was Iraq, there was Libya, North Korea, I think Syria, Iran, you know. And slowly over the last couple of decades, we've seen, you know, obviously we had Iraq, you know, taken down in the wake of 9/11. You know, then we had Libya with Gaddafi. And as far as we know, privately owned central banks were installed in those nations. So to me, the litmus test used to be, if a nation doesn't have a privately owned central bank, then it's not part of the globalist club. Firstly, as far as I know, Russia has long had a privately owned central bank, and I would say that it's been controlled essentially by the same Bolsheviks since the Second World War. But then now, since 2020, I would say the litmus test is vaccines, the COVID vaccine. So I'm only interested in any nation which didn't encourage its citizens to take a COVID vaccine. That, to me, that is now the litmus test. And again, as far as I know, Russia did. Russia encouraged everyone to take that. So I can't view Russia as being outside of the big boy club. Not entirely, anyway. I'm not, you know, they're, it may be that they're kind of in lockstep on certain issues, on the main issues, but maybe there's some tussling about, you know, who really gets to control the region of Ukraine and things. So, you know, and certainly there's definitely real war and destruction that's been happening there. I don't know if it's to the extent that our media has been portraying. Again, I'm going to say I don't know. But I just look at it and think, well, okay, this war has magically achieved the goals that they wanted through Agenda 2030. We're all now impoverished because of this war somehow. Funny how that happened. And yeah, Russia was not a rogue nation in terms of not imposing the COVID restrictions and vaccine on people. So, yeah.
See, what I would say, that there's a lot about this. And I don't know either. And I think it's good that you say you don't know. Because there are some people who claim that they know, they claim certainty about things prematurely. Yeah. And, you know, for example, Russia could have implemented the whole vaccine thing for their own reasons. Maybe, and I think the same with China, maybe. Who knows? Maybe they thought, well, this is good for us. It's good for us to have a frightened populace. It's good for us to have an ID register of who has and hasn't abided by the regulations and social expectations. Maybe they think it's good for them to have various things. And of course, there is the issue of the Sputnik vaccine. No one seems to know whether how similar it is to the Pfizer and AstraZeneca vaccines that the West got and Moderna. I don't know either. But either way, whatever was going on with Russia and during the COVID era, this is now a different thing, and you can say, well, maybe they were conforming with the global entities there, but they still had this beef with Ukraine. They still had this business that they wanted to deal with. Mm-hmm. And it seems to me that what happened was that Russia was goaded by the West, by America, into invading Ukraine. And once that happened, the West had a choice about whether, you know, you can be at war with Russia, or you can disapprove of Russia without sanctioning Russia. You know, it's not like the war, once the war started, well, then there are going to be Russia sanctions, which means there's going to be an energy shortage, which means there's going to be huge bills for ordinary people to pay. The war could have happened without any of that happening. So it was a choice of the West to introduce the Russia sanctions. So what I'm trying to say is, I think this, the whole thing doesn't need to have been orchestrated. Our reaction to it was, I think, could have been orchestrated.
Could it's have like, been okay, opportunism.
Exactly. So, we can make this work for us. We can now impoverish people even further than we did with the lockdowns. We can now do it even further by making their energy much more scarce than it was before.
Yeah, I can certainly allow for that, no problem. But what I'm interested in is Russia a rogue opponent of the so-called New World Order? No, I mean Belarus for a while. His name is Lukashenko, isn't it? I don't know what his position still is now, but I know at the beginning he claimed to have refused the bribe from the IMF to lock down his nation.
Yes, and it was a huge bribe.
Yeah, and to me that was the mark of a genuine challenger to the New World Order. So yeah, I mean, I'm not going to say that the Russia Ukraine war is completely orchestrated. As I say, I don't know. I do think that at the very least it was seized upon as an ideal serendipitous opportunity by the rest of the world, essentially the Western elite. Certainly, I shouldn't use the word elite. The Western tyrants. It was seized upon by them as a way of furthering an agenda which was already underway. And I would just say, I don't see how anyone can look at Russia and see them as any kind of savior whatsoever.
Well, I agree with you. I mean, even in the best of times, it's still a very different culture. It's still a very different people. Very different expectations.
Well,
of
actually, that's a really important thing that I'd like point I'd like to make. There is, I think, so many people, and it's very difficult not to phrase it this way. But people talk about Russia versus America, but it's really important to remember that it's the Russian policymakers, it's the Russian state, and it's not the Russian people, it's not the American people. You know, and I think it was Godfrey Bloom was saying how he's now come to be quite opposed to America, and I know that he meant the American state, the American regime. He didn't mean the American people.
Absolutely.
But it is really important to mention that.
It is, because people get hurt. And, you know, it's not necessary. It shouldn't be like that, because, you know, I'm not blaming the British people for the Iraq war or whatever. You know, I don't feel that I'm responsible for the Iraq war. So I think that there should be an understanding there that we're not blaming. It is to do with the governments of those countries and other entities who are influencing or in control of those governments, including the UN and so on. So, yeah, I think that's important. And I do understand why people get hurt by it. But, yeah, it's not necessary. What would you say about the long term, what we're dealing with now? So there is the energy shortage. We don't know how severe that is going to get in terms of how it's going to affect life in general. But what about the other things that were talked about last year, like digital ID, digital currency, Vax Pass, social credit score, and all of that? Because some people say that COVID is over, so all of that is off the table, and you are scaremongering.
No chance. I can't see them relinquishing any of that, any of the gains that they've made. I will concede that these things may take a bit longer than I thought they would, because I mean, in 2020 everything was moving so fast that it felt like by 2022, you know, we would have a CBDC, a central bank digital currency, and a digital ID and things like this. It, you know, it really did feel like that. Everyone I knew thought that, you know, for example, the live music industry just wasn't going to come back and things like this. But those things kind of have come back. And it may take a bit longer. You know, I think the one sort of prediction which I was hammering over 2020 and 2021, which I will concede has not played out how I thought it would, is that World Bank document said that we would have lockdowns until March 2025, and that's obviously not been the case. Certainly not to the extent that many of us thought. And but then again, you know, we've got this new Oxford Smart City thing, which is kind of like a lockdown. So the idea of climate lockdowns is definitely a real prospect. Yeah, we don't know what's. I think it is a bit foolish to kind of to talk about which predictions have and haven't come to pass at this point in time, because You know, we're 2.5 years on from, or, you know, nearly 3 years on from the emergence of COVID. As much as has happened in the last 3 years, there's still, you know, I mean, it's called Agenda 2030 for a reason. And the reason for that is because they want the vast majority of their sustainable development goals in place by 2030. So I think I would say that by 2030, we will have a CBDC, whether it has replaced the pound sterling or the US dollar, I don't know, but it will certainly be running in parallel to it by that point, and digital ID. And I can't see it playing out any other way, because this is something that they've been working towards for decades. There are countless documents talking about it. they've been working on CBDCs for really for the last couple of years publicly, and I would suggest that they've probably been planning them for a lot longer than that, because they do want a society where you are trackable everywhere you go, where you can be surveilled everywhere you go. As I say, Agenda 2030 involves humanity being inventoried in the same way that cattle is. You know, they talked about the 2010 to 2020 was the UN's declared decade of immunization and vaccinations. You know, they do have these plans, and they are working towards them. So, I can't remember exactly what we talked about last year, but I would say that people needn't be too concerned about it, because, well, people should be concerned about it, but people should have been working towards hedging against these things by now. And earlier I listened to your stream with Golden Age Man, which I thought was really good. He's made really bold steps towards detaching from the system, not being dependent on that system that they want for us. Obviously Woodlander is, and I've said a few times that I think Woodlander is probably the most significant person in the dissident right, because he's offering the most workable solutions of anyone, I think, which at this point in time, it's the solutions, it's the practical aspect of it that's the most important.
Oh, I agree. And I think he's, I don't want to embarrass him, but I see him as a bit of a hero, because he's really living the example. He's setting an example. And I think it's very admirable. But
yeah, go on. I was going to say, he's been an example to me, and you know, I mean, I did encourage people to consider investing in crypto a few years ago, and that was a means to an end. It's not quite playing out how many of us hoped, and I think, you know, I mean, that's a whole other issue. But the idea was, right, this new digital control system is coming in. We need to create some kind of financial independence. And we need to try and find the fastest route to that. But I made a big move to rural Wales. I live, you know, pretty much in the middle of nowhere, with a couple of acres of land, and you know, we've got chickens, and we've got we're growing vegetables and things like that, and we've got a private well and things like that. So those kind of solutions that Woodland has been talking about since 2020 have only been proven, that the importance of them has only been more and more proven over the last couple of years. And I really hope that a lot of people, I mean, I did a poll on Telegram a few months ago, asking which steps people have taken towards kind of detaching from the system in some way, you know, building community, buying land, you know, things like that. And I was so heartened to see how many people have made those positive steps. I think it's absolutely brilliant, and I think a large part of that is due to the Woodlander, and you know, perhaps a small part is due to the ideas that I've been putting out there as well.
Oh, I would definitely think so. I mean, it's always nice to know that you've actually had a positive influence on people, that they're actually doing things that you've suggested or moving in ways that you've suggested. And I think, but I also think it's important not to browbeat people about it, because that just, you know, turns them off. I think the best thing that you can do is set an example and hope that other people, I think that's better than preaching at them. Because when people see that something is, when they see that someone else is doing something, then they know it feels a lot more possible for them. It feels a lot more tangible and likely than if they don't see, and it's just sort of in the air, like a notion that maybe you could do this, maybe someone should do this, etc. One last thing before we get to that, one last thing about the, when I was saying about the predictions, and I really don't like this thing about predictions, because it's like, what time?
It's like a competition, yeah.
Exactly. It feels juvenile. Because, okay, so let's say that this prediction is wrong, but it's kind of right, or there's a strand of it reappears in this other thing that does happen. Well, then, but you didn't predict that other thing. This is just silly. We should be talking about general trends, zeitgeists, I suppose, things that you can, that are visible, not necessarily predicting what they're going to do next. However, one thing that is worth saying is whichever predictions have come true from 2020 and 21, well, first of all, it's only a year. You know, give it time. But secondly, these people are saying this stuff themselves, and not just in arcane documents and huge books and whatever, and not just in fancy speeches at events that don't mean anything. They're saying it openly at events that do matter, and they are very closely connected with the governments of the West. There is the famous quote from Klaus Schwab that, you know, and it was a weird wording that he chose. It's oddly sexual that we have penetrated the governments. And also oddly James Bond villain-esque. It's like he was trying to play up to that stereotype. But he said that they're in all the governments. And I think he even said that more than half of the government of Argentina or some country, that they're World Economic Forum graduates. And you know, so then people would say, well, it doesn't actually matter that they're graduates. But, okay.
Well, what I find fascinating about that is that they have, you know, entities like, you know, these kind of, you know, transnational entities like the WEF have categorically and provably had their tentacles in government for decades. Yet they've chosen the last couple of years to openly reveal that fact. And I think there's something quite significant about that. I think I almost feel like in order to get to their destination where they wanted this, this technocracy, this global governance, as opposed to national governments, they knew that they couldn't get there without revealing publicly to, I remembered a quote in a book that I've been reading lately, a book called, Mapping the Millennium by Terry Boardman. And I'm only sort of a chapter or two in, but I just want to read a bit out because I think that's quite relevant here. He talks about a Japanese expression called Funiki Zukuri, which means creating an atmosphere. If a politician or party wishes to bring about a certain outcome which society will accept as a de facto event, they need to be first subconsciously and then later consciously convinced of its inevitability. You do not simply put forward your idea saying this must happen. You approach it obliquely from various angles and through various media. You saturate the social atmosphere with a more or less conscious expectation of the event, and then when everyone is ready to accept it, you bring it consciously forward, and hey presto, it is accepted almost as a matter of course. And I think there's an aspect of this that they need us to they need people to kind of subconsciously internalize the idea that we do have this technocratic global governance, so that when it emerges openly, we're not shocked by it, you know. And I kind of feel like that's what's been happening.
And also they want to create the sense that they want people to think that this is necessary and right, so we must have CBDCs. It's inconceivable that we wouldn't have a future of CB. Of course, we've got to have those. It's unthinkable. And then got to have the vax pass because we want everyone to be safe. It doesn't even need to be justified. It's just, you just state that it is already justified.
Yeah. And I mean, this is another of the kind of pet theories that people have not been too comfortable with me putting this forward. But in my view, it's highly plausible that we're actually seeing national governments self-sabotage to an extent. And I mean, I don't see, for, you know, objectively, I don't see how anyone looking at the state of the British government, you know, first you have the buffoon Boris Johnson, then you have Liz Truss come in for a couple of weeks, whatever it was, a month, who is obviously and clearly inept and not up to the task. And that was quite publicly demonstrated in some of the clips we saw of her walking the wrong way out of a press meeting and things like that. And then, you know, we have Rishi Sunak come in, who most people, you know, think is not fit for the task. You had the clip recently of Justin Trudeau being given a dressing down by, I think it was either the Chinese president or you know, one of the higher ups in China. And I see things like this, and I think things like this don't happen in the media by accident. And to me, they're trying to cheapen the idea of national government, of the state. They're trying to undermine it in the public mind. And I think that goes to what you're saying, you know, so that they can then say, look what a mess your government made of this whole thing. Look what a mess they made of the vaccine rollout. Look what a mess Liz Truss made of, you know, economic factors and the decline of the pound against the dollar and things like this. Wouldn't it be better if you just had this strong CBDC? You know, even better than that, what about if we had a global currency and then you wouldn't have to worry about the exchange rate with other currencies and, you know, things like this. It's, to me, it's all... Everything can be explained by problem, reaction, solution. And, you know, this is a phrase, yes, it comes from David Icke. The idea that they create a problem, they know what the public reaction is going to be, and they have a ready-made solution for it. And you can apply that to so many things. And it's a really uncomfortable thing to kind of, you know, and as I say, I know a lot of people listening to this are not going to like what I'm saying. But to me, there is some plausibility to this.
Yeah, definitely. And this is also relevant to, again, with COVID, you saw how they managed or attempted to manage, and I think successfully did manage, public perception of the problem, and then and then had the public clamoring for the vaccine. I mean, it was remarkable how well. Mm. And what scares me the most is that they managed that really well, but they will have learned from it. They will have learned from the process of the last 2 years. Well, yeah, 3 years. They'll have gleaned a lot of new information about what worked, what didn't work, what could have been more successful, and the things, the pitfalls, and also the types of people who rebel and kick up a fuss and whatever. That scares me a lot. You know,
yeah, because I mean, they can come out. You know, we've had you know, one of the big things in the British news for the last few weeks has been the illegal migrant crossings and the migrant crisis. And they know just how far they can push that without the public, you know, blowing a lid. And they've learnt that from COVID. They've learnt how far now they can push the public without a strong kind of, you know, blow off of steam from people. And it turns out that they can push people pretty far before anyone reacts.
Yeah. And of course, the big question here is that what will make the public react? And I do wonder about that. And this is the big question that's been on my mind for the last 3 or 4 months, I guess, 6 months. I do wonder how the public will behave when they don't have luxury anymore. Because all through COVID, with the lockdowns and the annoyances, the inconveniences, basically people still had luxury. They still had clean running water. The internet still worked. Electricity. Even food. Basically, everything still worked okay. Certainly heating. So, but now that looks like it might deteriorate. So my question, I guess, is, and I'm not asking you for an answer necessarily or even a prediction.
I can give one.
How will they behave when things go bad?
My prediction is, and I know we just talked about not giving predictions, but my prediction is that... they will push the cost of living crisis just far enough that people beg for a solution. you know, like seriously beg, say, look, this cannot go on. We need the government to step in and do something. And then they will step in with something akin to UBI, you know, whether it be some means tested thing, whether it be, you know, based on how much money people have in the bank account, how much they earn, whatever. There will be some kind of, I mean, they've already started this, haven't they? With, you know, giving people a help with the cost of living, you know, a fuel
furlough allowance.
And the furlough scheme, yeah, of course. They've already started with that. And these are trials. These are just kind of them testing the water with these things. But I don't think they're going to allow the so-called cost of living crisis to go far enough that people become seriously impoverished, you know, so that civilization breaks down and that you have widespread, obvious poverty. Because we have to remember that our comfort, bread and circus, is key to their control over us. Without that, they don't have anywhere near the control that they want to have over us. So I don't think that they'll allow this manufactured crisis to go that far. I think that they will step in just at the right moment, at that sweet spot. And again, they've learned this from COVID. They've learned where that sweet spot is. They've learned how far they can push people before people, you know, become seriously agitated about it. And they'll use that knowledge. They'll know exactly when to step in and say, look, okay, you know, we know we have to step in, and, you know, it's going to cost the nation a lot of money, and we're going to have to, you know, rework the financial system and things like this. But, you know, you've begged for the solution, you know, to this problem. You've reacted. We've got the solution. Here it is. And I think that will be the start of something that really resembles UBI, Universal Basic Income, which I think is key to the system that they want for the future.
It's just incredible. When I, well, in 2013, I discovered a channel called Davis MJ Arini on YouTube.
It
gets a bad rap now. I think it's a bit unfair because, honestly, his early videos were very good and really good stuff. And he had one about the post-scarcity society. I downloaded most of his videos, but I didn't get them all. And then his channel was shut down. It's real annoying. But I do have the one about the post-scarcity society. I think he also did one about universal basic income. And the point is that this was a topic that some people were aware of in 2013. Now, I dare say people were aware of it a long time before then. It's a notion, a concept. But it was there in 2013 enough that someone on YouTube would make a video about it. Mm. And when I saw it about then, shortly after he put it up, and it seemed like science fiction. Right, that's the thing. That's the point I'm making. It seemed like something, okay, this might well be relevant 40, 50 years from now. And now here it is relevant less than 10 years later. This is amazing to me.
And that's the magic. That's the spell that they cast. That's what they create through things like COVID, is they create the... they make what seemed fantastical, realistic through these manufactured crises.
Exactly. Yeah. And because they've changed people's expectations, they've changed people's notion of what it is to be in this, in the West, in their society. So, and this is, it's quite astonishing because, as I say, it seemed like something that, and I found it an interesting concept. It was interesting to think about and to contemplate, but I didn't think it would be actually relevant to life for a long, long time, because I just thought, well, how could they do that? I mean, how could you have post-scarcity? It just didn't seem like it seemed like pie in the sky. But I think, and this is why I wanted to get, there are various people that I wanted to get onto Millennial last year and the year before who declined or ignored the invitations. But it was annoying because I wanted to get them on so that they could discuss this, so that they could explain it to me. Like Catherine Austin Fitz, for example, I really wanted to get her on to talk about how this economy would work. How would the post-scarcity economy actually work? So it's because it is fascinating, and I don't know how correct she is. I don't know how much she's being vindicated.
I'd say quite a lot.
She definitely went. Yeah, she definitely went all in. I mean, she was saying that this is it, as you've been saying, that the world is never going to be the same again. And of course, Klaus Schwab was saying that himself, and politicians, national politicians, were saying the same thing. We're never going back. But I wish that I'd been able to get her on to describe how this is actually going to work, because it does seem like it's what they're going for. They don't want people, having a job, having a career, saving up money, getting on the property ladder, amassing wealth, bequeathing it to their children, having children, and bequeathing their wealth to their children. That seems to be a way of life that worked for a few centuries, but that is now on the way out.
Yeah, absolutely. I think Catherine Austin Fitz has done a few videos where she has basically explained that. I mean, it seems to be playing out as she describes. And, a lot of people are talking about this. I mean, it's a shame that Computing Forever wasn't able to do Millennial this year, because he's been very good on investigating this. He had a conversation with someone called Rosa Coiry, who's very, very knowledgeable about Agenda 21 and the technocratic system, who sadly died about a year ago. She's very knowledgeable. Last year you had Mark Malone on, Millennial. He's very knowledgeable about this stuff. So there are people who knew what was coming and have a very kind of technical understanding of how this is all going to work better than I do. But essentially, I believe what they want is some form of CBDC, a digital currency linked to UBI. Eventually, people will have a certain amount of credits, dropped into their wallet each month to cover the cost of living, which everyone has been struggling to meet and cried for a solution to. Those credits won't be that they'll probably expire after a certain amount of time, because they don't want people being able to save or amass wealth or certainly pass wealth down. Obviously, being blockchain technology or digital technology, it will be programmable. So if you try and buy fuel 100 miles from your home, then the transaction may be declined because you're too far out of your zone. And we're seeing this come in with Oxford. They already have plans, quite imminent plans, for creating a situation for residents of Oxford where they can only leave the city a certain number of times a year, and can't travel more than a certain distance. So it's not science fiction. I agree. A few years ago, it did seem like science fiction, but not anymore. The gel that holds all of this together, the thing that makes it possible, is the digital currency, the central bank digital currency, and that will be issued by the central bank, not by retail banks. So I think you'll find. I mean, for example, I had a my bank, who I've been banking with since I was 15 years old, if not longer. That's 24 years ago. I've been with the same bank that entire time. Last week, they sent me a letter saying that they're closing my account because they believe I've been using it as a business account. Now, I have been, but I've been doing that for the last 9 years. So why are they suddenly interested in that now? Why are they bothered about what they deem to be business transactions now? And I would suggest that all of these retail banks are kind of winding down their operations to some extent or other. They don't seem to want our business as much as they used to. And that is probably because in a few years' time, we are going to be dealing directly with the central bank, with the Bank of England, in America, with the Federal Reserve, rather than with, NatWest or, Royal Bank of Scotland or, any of these things. So, that's the kind of future we're looking at. And it sounds grim, but, again, we just need to reduce our dependence on these things. We need to have wood burning stoves so that we don't need to buy their, pay for mains gas and things like this or electric. We need to work towards these things and reduce our dependence on their financial system.
Well, absolutely. And I think it's worth bearing in mind that even if all of these notions become irrelevant and all the predictions, if none of them come true, it's still good for people to be independent of the system. Mm. To maximize your own self-sufficiency, your own ability to get by without dependence on others. I mean, this is it's like a key thing. It used to be understood, I think.
It's always been understood. I mean, there are verses in the Havamal, which, you know, from the Poetic Edda, from Iceland, which talk about how important it is to be your own man, to not rely upon another man, even if you live in poverty. It's the dignity of being a man. It's always been seen that way.
Sorry, yes, precisely. And this came up in the discussion with the with Golden Age Man and at least one other this year. I think that self-sufficiency, I mean, it appeals to male instinct. You know, it appeals to very much the male psyche, having your safe castle and having within that castle all the things that you will need. I think that's, and the castle is defendable and all that. Hmm. I think that's extremely, that just appeals to people.
And I do, at this moment, I do have to kind of give a nod to Varg Vikernes, for those who know who he is, because he has been pushing the principle of self-sufficiency for years and years and years, long before COVID came in. And he built that kind of life for himself. I mean, yeah, he had the ability to do that because he was kind of independently somewhat wealthy from his musical career. But he's been pushing that idea for a long time. And any, you know, slight, you know, differences that he and I may have had over the years, I will always be grateful for him for at least planting that seed among so many people, including myself. I mean, that's really where I first came across the idea of being self-sufficient as a goal to aspire to.
Yeah, I mean, I think that he delivers the message in a certain abrasive manner that turns a lot of people away.
Yeah.
Which is kind of unfortunate. But yeah, I think the general notion of, I mean, and this is the thing, self-sufficiency doesn't need to equate to being a difficult, antisocial misfit. Anyone, you know, it should appeal to a broad range of people. And there was the thing in the 70s, I think you'll know about this fad of what was called the good life, when you would get out of the rat race in London and have a small farm or live in suburbia with a nice garden where you grew your own fruit and vegetables. And I think it does just appeal to people, and it should. You know, it's right. I think this is something sort of, what's the word, primordial.
I actually just this afternoon I had a very civilized kind of very middle-aged sort of drinks do with my local neighbors where I live. You know, my nearest neighbor is about half a kilometer away, but you know, the kind of handful of neighbors that we have around here, we had them over, and the kind of camaraderie that you have with other rural living people, you realize that there is a real kind of like authenticity, a real sincerity and nobility to those kinds of people. And they all do deep down, they're striving for the same thing. And yeah, I mean, our parents' generation, they had, you know, the Self-Sufficiency Guide by John Seymour and a lot of these books in their bookshelf about growing your own veg and things like this. And I know Woodlander talked about how his, I think it was his grandparents, I'm not sure if it was his parents, how they had a veg plot in their garden and things like that. So it's the norm, not the not the abnormality. It's how we've always lived. And I think particularly in England, there's always been this, I mean, the old saying, an Englishman's home is his castle, it's a very real part of the English and, you know, probably more widely British psyche.
Absolutely. When I was preparing for this speech that I gave at Nomos, I was doing research about G.K. Chesterton and finding different quotes that I thought would be integrated into the speech in some way. It ended up being sort of superfluous, but it was inspirational. Certainly, it was relevant. And one of them was that home is the place, and I'm going to butcher it here. He said something like, home is the place where you are truly free because you don't have any, You can do what the heck, you literally can do whatever you want inside your home, as long as it's not like killing someone. you can behave however you want and yeah. do whatever you want whenever you want. And so it's a thing that, yeah, an Englishman's home is his castle. It's a matter of fulfillment. And
not since 2020, though, is it? You know, I mean, that's well, yeah. what a fundamental change to say who you're allowed to invite into your home. You know, and I should hope that most people listening to this ignored that diktat.
Did you see that funny joke about this is about the six people, yeah, maximum of six people allowed in a house? And there was a joke that a policeman at the front door saying, can I come in and count make sure that you've only got six people in your house? And the guy says yeah. no, because then there'll be seven people.
I've not heard that, but yeah.
That was very amusing. Sorry I interrupted you there.
No, that was the end of my point.
All right. So I think the key thing is, and you wanted to emphasize this, was the notion of self-sufficiency and detaching from the system. Now, the Woodlander, you know, both times I've had him on, I wanted to talk to him about self-sufficiency and make it in off-grid living and so on, and just make it very focused on that. But both times we ended up talking about other things. But, you know, he can deliver that knowledge elsewhere. So it's not the end of the world. But I think it is a very important thing and something that I want to get into myself and spread to other people, that this notion about things like solar panels, things like collecting rainwater, things like growing your own fruit and vegetables, it just seems exciting. And I'm sure a lot of it is, you know, donkey work and onerous, but still, at the end of the day, you are living free of the whole complexity of systems that are in place to do all of this stuff for us. But of course, at the cost that you live a very artificial life. And that's key to how we've become so perverted. I mean, this is just, you know, what I'm saying is so sort of banal, and yet it's so pregnant with meaning. It really is. It sounds banal, but it's so important. Yeah,
I think it's really daunting, you know, when someone says to you, you need to be self-sufficient, you think, well, you know, if you're in your early 20s and, you know, you either don't have a job or you've got a job earning average wage, you know, you know, if you, especially if you live in the south of England or even the Midlands now, the idea of being able to buy even a flat it seems completely, you know, unrealistic. And I am sympathetic towards that, but I think people need to stop looking at it as an all or nothing situation. You can be 1% self-sufficient. You can be 3% self-sufficient. You can be 90% self-sufficient. Very few people are ever going to be 100% self-sufficient. And even Woodlander will admit that he's not 100% self-sufficient. The point is that you're working towards it. And, you know, I did a podcast with the Woodlander, which was a really good conversation. And it was basically all about this. And one of the things he said is, you know, just get a bucket, grow some potatoes. You can do that if you live in a flat. And it's incredible because, you know, it's quite easy to do. They don't take much tending to. And it can form quite a bulk of your diet. You know, you can go and purchase some meat from a local butcher if you eat meat or whatever. You can have your potato from your own bucket, and it's a start. It's a step in the right direction. You know, Woodlander, I believe, is working with people to buy areas of land. So you can collectively buy some land. You only need a few thousand pounds, I think, with some of these initiatives. Even if you're, you know, I've got good friends who are renting or even in council houses who are growing their own fruit and vegetables, and they have their own hens. You know, they maybe have solar panels and things as well. So they don't even own their property, but they're still managing to be to a large degree self-sufficient. And I think it's more important than the kind of tangible results of being self-sufficient is the mindset of getting into that mindset of saying, you know, I don't need the government or the supermarkets to provide for me. You know, I have some agency to go out and do that for myself. So, I'm far from self-sufficient myself. We're working towards it, you know, it, at our own pace, as kind of, I'm not going to say as quickly as we can, because it's not a race, but we are working towards it. My wife and I, we've got children who we get to chip in with it. We homeschool the children. We're growing some of our own vegetables. We're getting some fruit trees soon. We've got 8 hens. And I mean, that's such a wonderful thing. You know, like anyone who's got a little, even if you've just got a reasonable sized garden, get some hens, because they're actually a real joy, to be honest with you. They, you know, you find that they've got characters. They're not that high maintenance. You know, you kind of, you know, you muck out the coop every, you know, few days or whatever. You feed them some corn and things like that, and you make sure that foxes can't get them. Other than that, they'll lay, you know, these wonderful, huge, healthy eggs for you. And they're actually characters. So you know, it is a real joy. Yes, it is work and everything, but it's definitely a fulfilling, you know, ambition. It's great. And I would encourage everyone to just work towards it. And it, like I say, you know, it can be daunting when someone says you need to be self-sufficient, but it's not a binary thing. It's not an either or. It's in degrees. And there are countless degrees between being, you know, dependent on the system and being independent of the system.
Absolutely. And, you know, to be 5% self-sufficient is better than being 0% self-sufficient.
Oh, exactly. Yeah.
So it's not like everyone needs to aim for 100%. I'm not saying that. And it would be ridiculous for me to say that, especially in my own current situation. All I'm saying is this is objectively a good thing. It shouldn't need to be justified, really. I think what people need is to see that it is possible, because I think it's self-evidently a good idea. But it's self-evidently a good idea, even if the Agenda 2030 stuff is a load of schizoid, paranoid, conspiracy, loon stuff. It's still a good idea.
to be self-sufficient from the
system as much as possible.
Yeah.
So I think this is something that, you know, I want this to spread. And I also think that it will probably lead us in the distant right towards people who are good at that, but aren't actually that political. So in other words, it would help to breathe new life into people, because otherwise, you know, we can sit and talk about how bad everything is ad infinitum, and talk about, you know, the course of the 20th century ad infinitum. But in the end, it's not going to help us.
If I could just add something else to that, actually, something which I don't think gets spoken about very often, but anyone who's begun living more rurally will know this, especially if you're homesteading. You find that you're in a situation where, right, okay, suddenly you need firewood. You know, you may not have your own bit of woodland, so you need firewood. So you speak to your neighbour and you say, you know, do you know anywhere I can get firewood? They say, oh yeah, my mate John, you know, just lives down in the village. He can do you a trailer full of firewood for this amount of money. You phone him up, he'll come along, he'll drop it with you, you pay him in cash. You are literally putting your money into the local economy, and because you're rural, they tend to be people who are ethnically similar to you. They tend to be British people, and they're people who are just like you. They love their rural surroundings. They rely on word of mouth. They're, you know, somewhat mistrustful of the system of the government, especially in America. You know, I'm sure people like Golden Age Man are finding that the people he's going to be living amongst are generally quite you know, skeptical of government. So, you know, when we talk about in like nationalist circles, we talk about you know, helping our own. We talk about creating our own network, our own infrastructure, our own economy. That kind of already exists. It's the default when you're in a rural area. You know, you need a plumber. You don't, you know, you don't go online and you know, go on one of those directories and look for like some kind of national conglomerate who will send like their local operative to you. You speak to your neighbor and you say, you know, who does your plumbing? And they'll say, oh yeah, such and such just down the road does that. You give them a ring. It's local people, and you find that so many of the things which help you to do your homesteading are aided by local people who are ethnically similar to you, of a similar mindset. You're giving them your money, they're giving you their money. You know, it's it just kind of works that way by default.
That's the way that life used to be for everyone, yeah. Really.
Yeah, and it still is like that to an extent. Even as digital as society is these days, word of mouth is still king.
Yeah, Padfa says localism is best. Yeah. And Iron Will says homogeneity just works.
Who'd have thought?
I wish it were that simple, but yeah, generally speaking, it certainly works a lot better than the alternative. So, yeah, okay. Well, is there anything else that you'd want to say before we wrap up?
No, I think we've kind of covered everything we said we were going to cover. It was, it was really good meeting you at Pagan Futures.
Oh, yes,
in the flesh.
Yes, we're gonna bring that up. Yeah, that was that was a conference that, it was organized by Survive the Jive and a friend of mine, and I'm not a pagan myself. I'm sort of just agnostic, but
it was, you got stuck in with your questions though.
Oh. Yes, I did. Yeah. Well, that's an that was one question that I asked, because I think it's a very relevant thing. But it wasn't I wasn't trying to be a bitch or anything like that. I wouldn't want you to think that. But I just thought it was an important question. It was about genetic engineering.
Yes.
And that was, that's terrible. I've forgotten the other speaker's name. But Survive the Jive, Tom
Bruja Villalonga.
That's it. Yeah. And then you were there to provide music in between the speeches. So it was I genuinely enjoyed it. I pushed it, and I hope that other people, I don't know if there is going to be another one next year. I hope there is. And if there is, I hope that people go to it, because it was very interesting, even as someone who doesn't have a dog in that fight, so to speak, at least not religiously speaking. I don't, but
it was great. Yeah, maybe I do. I wish I hadn't had to rush off at the end, because there was a really good social atmosphere later on. I don't know how late you stayed. I didn't get a chance to talk to you as much as I'd have liked to, but there were a good bunch of people, in the bar area, socializing, having a few drinks, and I gather staying on quite late. But I had to get home, and I was driving as well. So, but it was a really good event. It was really, really positive, and I really enjoyed it. Despite the kind of pressure that's on you when you're performing at something like that, whether as a speaker or, as a musician or whatever, but I really enjoyed it, and it was great meeting some people there whose content I've been watching for years. I think Duke of Durham was there, and it was really good meeting him and a few other people. There was the Chad Pastoralist and a few really good people.
Aureus Press was there.
Yeah, Aureus Press. Yeah, it was good. I spoke to him. Yeah, it was excellent. And it was the first time I'd met Tom Rousel, Survive the Jive, as well. And, considering the kind of online friendship we've had, with him using my music for years for the intro for his videos, it was really great to meet him in person as well. And obviously yourself as well. So, yeah, it was a really positive event, subject matter aside.
It's one of those things. It's a funny thing that we're connected online. We speak frequently online. We collaborate online. But there needs to be a good reason for us all to meet up in real life, It's like because we're living apart, so quite distances and all that. So just that reason alone is a good reason to put on these events, I think. Mm. And of course, lots of other people can join. And it seemed that I heard so much good feedback from it. I think loads of people had a good time. There were people there even from America.
Yeah.
People who'd come across the Atlantic for
Australia, America, yeah, it was incredible, yeah.
Amazing. Yeah. So yeah, I do hope that they do another one of those, and I'll be sure to advertise it if that does happen. So all right, and the other thing, oh yes, of course, the other thing you wanted to mention was the podcast, which you've begun since you were last on Millennial last year. Do you want to talk about that?
Yeah, I'll briefly shill that. I mean, I started that earlier this year. A few people had asked me to A few people had said to me that they didn't feel that there were many good pagan podcasts out there, and the ones that were out there were very American-centric. And you know, the Americans have their own style of dealing with these subjects and things. So a few people asked me if I would consider starting up a podcast about paganism, basically. And you know, I'm not going to pretend to be the most knowledgeable person. I mean, in terms of kind of the academic side of things or the historical side, I'm certainly not as well versed in the history of it as someone like Tom Rousel is. But I have been a practicing pagan for you know, quite a few years. And I know how daunting it can be for people who they like the idea of paganism. They feel like it makes sense from a kind of an identitarian point of view. But they don't know how to begin. They don't know where to begin, you know, what it entails, things like this. And also the other thing is that because of the kind of unbound tyranny that we've seen over the last 3 years, a lot of people have kind of rediscovered God, so to speak. They've run to the arms of the church and things. And I'm not going to decry those people, because I can understand when you're facing the kind of, well, evil that we seem to have been facing for the last 3 years and will continue to, you do sort of start to think, well, you know, you need something to give you comfort in that time. You need the spiritual armor of God, to use the Christian terminology. But I wanted to let people know that actually you have an ethnic indigenous spirituality which offers everything that Christianity does. And that's been part of the purpose of the Fergan podcast, and it's not just about paganism, but everything that I discuss on the podcast. I've done episodes on Agenda 21 and the technocracy. I've done episodes on the artificial law system, things like that. But I've done it through the lens of a pagan. So it's kind of like a diverse array of subjects spoken about by a practicing pagan. So anyone who's interested in that, the podcasts are all available free on Telegram or Odyssey. Patrons get to hear them a week earlier. That's it.
All right. That's great. There are a few super chats, so I'll put those to you now. But first of all, somebody said that you look like a young Billy Connolly. So I don't know if that's a compliment or not. But
I'll take that. The funny thing was someone at the Pagan Futures event said, do you find it ironic that you're a pagan who looks like Jesus?
that's an awkward conversation there.
Yeah.
Okay, Black Pigeon Pilled asks the following.
I love that name, by the way, Black Pigeon Pilled. Yeah.
Does the Fergan feel greater affiliation with Thor of Norse tradition or the Dagda of the Celts? Are the ethnic varieties of pre-Christian polytheism superficial or significant?
That's a good question. When I first kind of came to discover my identity many years ago, some people listening might remember forums like Skadi Forum and Apricity. There were these kind of forums for people who were interested in exploring their ethnic identity. And back then, I got it into my head that my identity was Celtic, you know, being British, you know, I must be Celtic ultimately. And back then I did have a vague interest in the kind of more Celtic gods, but I came to realize that my father's English, my mother's Dutch. I am predominantly of Germanic ancestry, so it makes no sense for me to be worshipping any other than the English or Ingveonic Northwest European Germanic gods. So Thunor all the way, as opposed to Thor, to use the English name for him. But as with regards to whether they are the same gods, I believe so. Yeah, I know that some people won't like me saying that, but yeah, to me they're the same gods by different names.
All right. There were some things that I could say about this, but time is tight, so I'll just move forward. Unorthodox, no, I think that's Nomad, says, wait for the next fake pandemic, the real one. COVID was just a test run. I mean, that Bill Gates has said this, that there's, you know, when he, whatever he was, he said with that smirk on his face, you know, when the next pandemic hits, everyone will know that we're, I forgot what it was. It was quite a super villain kind of stuff.
Yeah. People have kind of speculated that, you know, maybe it was a fake pandemic, and that the vaccine that they, you know, encouraged everyone to get will actually protect them from the real pandemic, which will then, you know, kill off all of the dissidents who, you know, us stubborn gits who refuse to get that vaccine. I mean, that's speculation. I can't say that it's not going to play out that way. I don't think it will, but I can't say that it's not going to. But it doesn't matter to me, because all what matters is that we were in control of our destiny. We chose what to put into our bodies, and we weren't coerced into doing these things. So even if that's how it plays out, at least we still have our dignity.
Yeah, that's a good way to look at it. It's how I'm looking at it as well. That okay, maybe I'm going to die. That's a bummer, but
I don't think it'll play out that way. And
at least I still have my autonomy.
Yeah, I mean, I just, if you really, really think about it, almost everything that they do to us is with our consent. You know, if you really, really think about it, I mean, you could argue mass immigration, they do that without our consent. Yes, I agree. There are certain things which can't be explained that way, but they didn't force everyone to get the COVID vaccine. You know, people did that willingly. They've not forced everyone to school their children. They've not forced everyone to use their financial system. You know, we've done these things. Or their legal system. We have opted to do these things. And yes, it's difficult not to, but we still had a choice at every step of the way. So yeah, I mean, the reason I say that is because I do think, and this, it gets into an esoteric area, which I'm not going to get into now, but I do think that there is almost some kind of rule book that the tyrants who, you know, who are controlling society, that they need to work by. They can't just kill us. They need to coerce us into sacrificing our own dignity, our own lives, our own health, things like that.
Yeah. Yeah, that does seem to be a thing. It does seem to be a part of it that you have to consent to it in some way. Interesting. I mean, again, even with the masks, you know, they gave you an easy way out.
I mean, you've got
a medical condition.
Well, yeah, I was stood at one time. I was stood in a pub at the very, very height of lockdown, in front of two police officers, when mask so-called mandates were universal. Everywhere indoors, you were supposed to wear a mask. And I was stood without, I didn't wear a mask once during the entire COVID thing. And these two police officers were no more than 3 foot away from me. They both looked at me. They didn't say a word. You know, I think a lot of people overplayed how strictly enforced these things were. And as you say, there was an easy out. I have a medical condition. You know, it was, you know, easy.
It was so easy because they couldn't even ask you what the medical condition was, let alone proof of it. All you had to say was those words, and that's it. But I will say, I wasn't as ballsy as some people. You know, I did sometimes wear the mask just for the sake of, I just didn't want a confrontation. But latterly, it became very clear that you just don't need to do it. You just don't need to do it. So certainly for the last 6 months of it or whatever, I didn't. I never wore the mask. Burnsy says, just wanted to say thank you for your wonderful music from Walkinsman. The Firebow. Never know if it's bow or bow. The Firebow is now a new favourite of mine, and I love the story behind Suna, or Sun.
Oh, thank you very much for saying. Yeah.
Okay. Max Tube, thank you for that. Dave Martell, one's own home is better. A man is master in his home. A couple of goats and a corded roof is better than begging. Yes, indeed.
Thank you, Dave. Yeah.
And then Whitgeard says, I don't know if I'm pronouncing that correctly, but anyway, thanks to Dan for all he does with his podcasts, music and work, and for being a great lad. Excellent discussion. Well, thank you very much. And Whitgeard will be on... How do you say it?
Yeah, Whitgeard.
Whityard.
Whityard, yeah. Okay. It's, I believe it just, it's an old English word, combination of words meaning white guard. But yeah, he's a very good friend of mine, and he'll be very interesting to listen to on Millennial.
Indeed, he's going to be on in, let me see. I'm looking forward to that one.
I don't know anyone that is as knowledgeable about particularly Old English and Old Germanic languages. He's very knowledgeable about these things and quite fascinating to discuss such matters with. So anyone who's interested in that, definitely check out his Telegram channel.
Yeah, it's indeed. And that's on the 23rd. So another 5 days yet. So it's funny. I'm actually halfway through. This is like last night was the halfway point mark at the end of it. So it's weird. Halfway through Millennial. Anyway.
Bet it flies by. Yeah.
It actually, at this point, it does. I'm sort of really in the flow of it now, and it's just easy. It's like I'm enjoying it, and it's a rush, you know?
You can tell, yeah.
The first few days, I was still a bit ill as well, so it was quite difficult. But now I feel like it's you know, I'm in the flow of it. But yeah, so yes, that was Whityard. And then Dave Martell says hail, thank you very much.
Hail, Lady Dave.
Lady of Shalott says we have strayed so far from the lives we should be living. Authors like Thomas Hardy and William Morris and the Pre-Raphaelite painters understood this. They saw the rise of the machine and they feared the 20th century for what it would bring. Tolkien lived through the mechanization of war. Yes, indeed. This is a huge thing in itself. That topic alone. But the funny thing is, it's an interesting thought to think that we're now past the 20th century. All of that is over. All of that has taken place, and we're now in this new century. And it's difficult to know how it will be characterized. Even now, I mean, we're what, a fifth of the way through it, but who knows what's going to happen in the aftermath of the 20th century?
Yeah.
Sorry, I cut you off there.
I was just going to say that comment reminds me, you know, that final chapter in Lord of the Rings and Return of the King, when they return to the Shire. I mean, that definitely was a huge kind of formative thing for me. That really helped to shape my worldview, you know, this idea of the destruction of the Shire with this kind of industrialization. And you know, I've always, when I was just a musician, when people asked me what I was trying to do with my music, I said I was trying to take people back to a pre-industrial England, because to me that is kind of, that's one of the watershed moments. The Industrial Revolution is, I mean, I could be a bit more inflammatory and say Christianity, but you know, I think so many of us, Christian or pagan alike, can agree that the Industrial Revolution was in many ways the death of England.
Yeah. I don't think that's even a contentious thing to say. I mean, clearly it changed everything. Clearly it was a revolution. And I think we've never got over it. I think we still mourn the loss of what was there before and the life that we had before. Mm. Even those of us who were born centuries after it, like you and me. We instinctively feel that there was something lost, something sacred.
And we, you know, I know you, like myself, you know, we do enjoy some of these trappings of modernity, you know, I mean, we're talking, you know, on computers across the internet, which obviously wouldn't be possible without the Industrial Revolution. But, certainly if I could snap my fingers and make all of that go away in order to have a life close to nature where we still lived on the land, I would do it. I would sacrifice all of it.
Even Instagram.
Especially Instagram.
So would I, to be honest. Yeah. Okay, and then Hinchfoot. So thank you for that, Lady of Shalott. It's a very interesting comment. Hinchfoot says, do you know Jacques Fresco? He was a futurologist and technocracy resource-based global order guy. Jacques Fresco.
Was he the guy, I forget what the name of the project was, it was like, was he the guy that was featured on that, what was that documentary that everyone, Zeitgeist, the Zeitgeist film? There was a section at the end interviewing a guy who had this vision for a kind of high, technologically advanced future. I may be mixing him up with someone else, but...
No, you are correct. I've just looked it up, and he did feature... Peter Joseph featured Fresco in the film Zeitgeist Addendum,
yeah,
where his ideas of the future were given as possible alternatives. So
it's kind of like a Star Trek vision of the future, that. You know, this kind of idyllic, clean, futuristic, you know, urban society.
Oh, right. I haven't seen... I don't know if I actually did see the original Zeitgeist. I didn't know that there was an addendum. But yeah, it would be interesting to look at that stuff now in retrospect.
Yeah, I mean, those were big documentaries at the time. I think the first one concentrated, you know, that was where everyone started saying, oh, you know, the Son of God is really the Son of God. And, you know, it was kind of unraveling Christianity and things like that. I think, if I remember rightly, Zeitgeist Addendum was focused quite heavily on the financial system.
So, yeah. All right, interesting. Okay, well, that's something I'll try to make time for that and look it up, both of them. All right. Well, I think that's all the super chats. So, oh yeah, Rick Shaw said, and this was actually, this was during the previous stream, but he said, and sorry for missing it, he said, Argentina beat France. Glad the European team won. And then he's asked me about Klaus Schwab's Rothschild roots, because there's this annoying, persistent thing that Klaus Schwab is a Rothschild. As far as I know, it's a false thing. His mother, it was a different mother and all that stuff. So anyway, thank you for bringing that up yet again, Rick. He knows that it pissed me off that people kept spreading this stuff around.
Yeah, that annoys me too. It was easily proven misinformation. Yeah.
Okay, well, let's end it there. So this has been a good one. I think it's been very interesting, and I hope it's been useful and inspiring to people. I think that's the general idea. So let's see. Yes, I will be back in about 20 minutes with pessimistic idealism. And in the meantime, Dan from the Fergan, thank you for appearing on Millennial 8.
Thank you. Yeah, and wishing you and all the listeners a very good Yule.
Okay. Thank you. I'll see y'all soon.
We hope you're enjoying Millennial. The show must go on, but it needs your help. Sometimes the old ways are the best. To send Millennial Woes some special Yuletide cheer by post, you can use the P.O. Box. Address on screen now. Millennial amounts to 3 months of work for the vile blogger. Please help him continue. Until next time, enjoy the show and spread the word.